morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Wednesday, February 26, 2025. Some communities in Western Equatorial State are calling for change.
We look forward to your timely intervention and to see Western Equatoria flourishing once again under the strong and the peaceful government of SPLM in government.
An official of the Sudan Rapid Support Forces says the goal of forming parallel government is to address the humanitarian needs of millions of Sudanese.
This charter aims, of course, to address the root causes of wars, put a solid ground for durable peace, and on top of that, address the humanitarian catastrophe that millions of Sudanese people are facing right now.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some community leaders in Ezo County of Western Equatoria State say they have experienced atrocities, including alleged killings and raping of women and girls during the tenure of former governor Alfred Futuyo Karaba. The leaders are asking President Salva Kiir to swap the state from the SPLA-IO to SPLM loyal to the president. For VOA News, Matias Samuel Timoteo reports from Yambio.
Some residents of Ezo County marched to the county headquarters to present their petitions to the county commissioner asking President Salva Kiir to return Western Equatorial State back to the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and do appoint a new governor. The community's representative Benjamin Mario read part of the petition loud.
There were repercussions of kidnapping, sexual violence against women, massive displacement at Ezo Western Equatorial, also thousands of internal displaced persons. We, the people of Ezo County, place our unwavering trust in your leadership and your decision to be well-being of the people of South Sudan. We look forward to your timely intervention and to see Western Equatoria flourishing once again under the strong and the peaceful government of SPLM in government.
Colin Arketa Elia is the female chairperson of Ezo County. She says the women whose husbands and children were killed during the tenure of the former governor are suffering.
We were fearing for all what has happened to us by cutting our neck, by operating our stomach with children, by killing our lot of children. This one gives us a real trauma, which I don't know how it is going to be healed. As a woman, we have nothing to do in the world. We need only peace. Because if there is peace, this is where we can do a lot of things. We pay our children to school, we stay with them even at home, well, even with our husband. This one is our aim.
Cosmos Bonfos, a young Ezo County resident, says the youth in Western Equatoria want the state to be returned to SPLM-IG because no atrocities were committed when the ruling party ran things in the county.
During the ruling of IO in Western Equatoria State, IO has been torturing unnecessary detention of youth. False accusation against you that we are rebels. No free movement. That is why we need a total change. We here in Ezo have hosted thousands of IDPs who are coming from Tombora, which means Tombora, the great Western Equatoria, have been suffering. What we need next is let our president look forward to bring Western Equatoria back to SPLM-IG.
Ezo County Commissioner Abel Sudan says the SPLM loyal to President Kiir and the SPLM-IO can peacefully coexist.
We as the SPLM in IG, IO are not our enemies. We are appealing to our president of the Republic of South Sudan to make sure that peace is restored at grassroots and to all South Sudanese to travel without any difficulty on the road.
Bingo Elizabeth Gibson Doro, deputy chairperson of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition in Western Equatorial State, denies the allegations of atrocities committed by SPLM-IO soldiers in the state and accuses certain politicians in Juba of manipulating the situation in Ezo County for their benefit.
All the demonstration which is going on is a violation of the peace process. process. Under the leadership of SPLM IO, we have never washed our hands with the blood of the innocent civilians. All these killings is coming from some politicians from Juba who had been fueling the insecurities in Tumbra. I have not seen any report coming to me that this is my soldier or an SPLM IO who has raped or who has killed.
Last week, top state officials for the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition under the first Vice President Riek Machar said their members have been assaulted in Yambio and some they deserted their workstations after President Kiir fired Governor Alfred Futio Karaba. Residents of Yambio, Ezo and Tumbra counties celebrated the removal of Karaba, who issued the decree on national television 2 weeks ago. For VOA News, I am Matias Samuel Timatio, reporting from the capital of Western Equatorial State, Yambio.
An official of Sudan's Rapid Support Forces says the goal of forming parallel government recently in Kenya is to address the humanitarian needs of over 20 million Sudanese living in RSF-controlled areas. The RSF and other groups signed an agreement last week to form a government administration. Izzedine El-Shafi is the RSF Senior Advisor for Peace and Humanitarian Affairs. He tells my colleague James Batty, while there have been human rights abuses during the conflict in Sudan, the RSF has taken steps to deal with those committing the abuses.
This charter aims, of course, to address the root causes of wars, put a solid ground for durable peace, and on top of that, address the humanitarian catastrophe that millions of Sudanese people are facing right now. The majority of them live in RSF area after had been deprived from having these assistance deliberately by SAF, and also represent a major leap towards the formation of a temporary government. Government of peace and unity that this coalition plans to form in the near future.
Some people say that you are trying to further divide Sudan by this agreement. What do you have to say to that?
We plan to form this government to bring peace, either by negotiated solutions, which always preferable for us, but also by imposing peace through strengthening our military capabilities and practice our natural rights to defend our people. You know, James, in the past 24 months, we positively engaged in many peace talks. In all these initiatives, unfortunately, failed because of the lack of will from SAF, which maintain constant withdrawal from all these peace talks. So we thought also the political forces and other Sudanese people to take the responsibility and to move forward and to protect the civilians, to address the humanitarian crisis. James, the RSF controls more than 65% of the Sudanese territory, and the more than 20 million people live in the RSF control. All of them had been deprived from almost everything. So the role of this government is to fulfill this gap and to address the challenges that the Sudanese people are facing. Therefore, we call upon the world to address the humanitarian challenges and also to cooperate with this newly established government to be able to address these challenges.
Let me give you the chance to respond. There are allegations that the RSF has been committing atrocities in the areas under your control. What is your reaction to this allegation?
Of course, we cannot deny the fact that there are serious human rights violations committed during this war. However, the RSF implemented many measures to eradicate these violations. Just for example, the RSF established martial courts to investigate and prosecute the personnel who violate laws, and currently there are more than 2,000 personnel prosecuted out of about 400 RSF uniform who committed outlaw crimes. Also, the RSF formed an investigative committee to investigate in the major crimes in Darfur. But, you know, to stop the violations, we have to stop the war. The violations are only symptoms of this devastating war. And this, one of the core objective of this government is to stop the war, is to work hard with all peace seekers to put more pressure on the other side to either to come to the table and and reach to a negotiated solutions.
Do you think that setting up a parallel government is the best way to stop the fighting?
I believe so. This war has to stop and has to stop immediately. But with the current deadlock and the absence of the will from the other side, we have no choice but to form this government. First, to address the humanitarian challenges and to protect our civilians from the aerial bombardment. So with the government, we will be able to stop these atrocities, of course.
That's Izzedine Shafi, RSF Senior Advisor for Peace and Humanitarian Affairs. He spoke to my colleague James Batty earlier today. Aid agencies, including the World Food Programme, say purposeful obstruction by the Rapid Support Forces and fighting between the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudan Armed Forces affiliated joint forces along the route to Zamzam has prevented the delivery of much-needed aid to families trapped inside Sudan. 46 people were killed when a Sudanese military transport plane crashed into a residential neighborhood on the outskirts of Khartoum, the regional government said today. The French news agency AFP reports that the Antonov aircraft went down on Tuesday night near Wad Saidna Air Base, one of the army's largest military hubs in Omdurman, northwest of the capital. The army, which has been fighting with the paramilitary rapid support forces since April 2023, said the plane crashed during takeoff. 46 people were killed and 10 injured. A military source speaking to AFP cited a technical malfunction as the cause of the accident. Intense fighting in Zamzam camp in Sudan's north Darfur has forced the UN World Food Programme to temporarily pause distribution of life-saving food and nutrition assistance to famine heat camp for displaced people. WFP says over the past 2 weeks, escalating violence left WFP's partners with no choice but to evacuate staff for safety. The UN says the recent violence left Zamzam's central market destroyed by shelling, pushing residents of the camp, estimated to be 500,000 people, farther away from accessing essential food and supplies. WFP and other partners have been working to deliver food and nutrition assistance to displaced people and in and around North Darfur's Zamzam camp. These people will not receive support until WFP is able to resume activities and get humanitarian assistance to the area. Famine was confirmed in Zamzam last August. Since then, WFP has managed to transport just one convoy of humanitarian supplies into the camp despite repeated attempts. Poor road conditions during rainy season, purposeful obstruction by rapid support forces, and fighting between RSF and other Sudan Armed Forces affiliate joint forces along the route to Zamzam has frustrated many attempts by the UN to deliver food to the area. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new study indicates Sahel, Somalia, and the Lake Chad Basin are the new operating places for militant groups. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on sustained fighting by militant Islamist groups in Africa indicates three theaters account for 98% of the deaths linked to such groups: the Sahel, Somalia, and the Lake Chad Basin. Joseph Sigley, director of research at the center and the author of the study, discusses the reasons behind the rise in these regions with VOA senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi.
Well, I think it's important to underscore that, you know, the militant Islamist violence is concentrated in a couple of theaters. It isn't unfolding across the whole continent. But there's a combination of factors why these insurgencies persist in these theaters. The first is we're dealing with weak governments that have not been able to sustain a security presence in the affected territories. And this has been exacerbated by the pushing out of the UN peacekeeping forces in the Sahel, as well as some of the regional forces that have been assisting. Plus, over time, these insurgent groups in each of the different theaters have become more organized, and they've become better able to generate revenues, which have allowed them to sustain themselves, and they've grown more sophisticated. Al-Shabaab in Somalia, for example, is estimated to earn some $130 million a year in revenues. The JNIM coalition in the Sahel is estimated to bring in, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year. And so they're increasingly well-resourced and therefore more difficult to combat. And so I think in the process, we can also say that these militant Islamist groups are really acting more like organized criminal groups over time. And while they still invoke religion and grievances against the government as their motivation, the resource demand and the resource opportunities are also increasingly important in driving what we're seeing this. And as these groups have moved into more populated areas in the Sahel, for example, in the southern and central parts of the country, this is also a key reason for the fatalities we're seeing. I think it's important to be clear that the governments of these three theaters are making efforts to combat the insurgencies. They are using their forces and confronting them. And so part of the number of fatalities we're seeing are also due to battle-related deaths.
Any recommendations to deal with the core reasons behind the rise in civilian fatalities due to violence in Africa?
There are many actions that are needed to defeat these insurgencies and protect civilians. I think given how well established and organized these militant Islamist groups are in these theaters and the expansiveness of the territories that they're covering, you're going to need to see concerted regional efforts to defeat them. I don't think any one national army is going to be able to do this on their own. It's going to have to be a collective effort. And this will help generate more troops to both go on the offensive against these militant groups, while also holding territory and protecting civilians in areas that you control. And this is something that the security forces in each of these theaters have had a hard time doing. Naturally, you know, this has to go hand in hand with greater oversight of the security forces to curb the human rights abuses and fatalities caused by the security forces against civilians, and which alienate the population against support for the authorities in these countries. Finally, I would draw attention again to the importance of a whole of government approach. The civilian side is as important as the security side. You need to be building trust with local communities to gain their trust and cooperation in fighting the militant groups. And all of these insurgencies, they are not popular among local populations, but communities are afraid of them. And so the authorities need to be working with communities and earning their trust so that they can collectively push back on the insurgents. This requires protecting civilians. It will require helping to invest in some basic services and help these communities have a vision that things will be better with cooperation with the government and counter some of the narratives that the insurgents are putting out about the government just being corrupt and against local communities. I think this is especially important in the Sahel. We do need to see an accelerated transition back to civilian rule in these places as part of being more effective in defeating the insurgencies. The militaries can then focus on their job of fighting the insurgents and defending the communities, and then civilians can do more of the whole of government efforts of providing services, rebuilding economies, rebuilding coalitions with regional international actors, and creating an environment that can attract investment that's going to help rebuild the economies that are going to really be able to sustain the fight against the insurgents.
That's Joseph Sigley, Director of Research at the African Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking to my colleague, Mohamed Al-Ashanawi. Our words of wisdom for this Wednesday comes from Central Equatorial State.
I'm Robert Wane from South Sudan in capital Juba. My proverb is in Bari language, which says, Lele ngutu bain, logon jijukin, nyokunje kingajin kanyet, itolipudian, madikonje gokonan, tukorean, kode tumatan. In English, which says, no one can reverse his or her age to childhood, no matter what wealth or position he or she may have. Thank you so much.
You just heard that it is very difficult for you to reverse your age. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. From Europe to North America, nations are tightening their immigration policies. Now, Canada, along seen as the world's most welcoming nation, has introduced sweeping changes affecting international students. The reforms highlight a growing global trend toward more restrictive immigration policies. Arzuma Kampowore has more.
Canada is cutting the number of international students it accepts to 437,000, down 10% from last year. Sheikh Omar Kirakoya came to Canada from Burkina Faso less than a year ago. His journey mirrors that of thousands of international students across Canada.
I chose Canada because there were more opportunities in my field.
But it's harder now to stay and work in Canada after graduation. Prospective students will need to show they have more than $20,000 in savings instead of the previous $10,000 requirement. And to work in Canada after they get their degree, students need to be proficient in English or French, and they need to graduate in a field Canada really needs, like science, farming, or healthcare.
When I first left the country, it was to work in mining field. But now with the new immigration laws, I had to change my field of study because I had to adapt to the new laws.
Canadian officials say the new rules are designed to pause population growth in the short term to give the Canadian government time to improve access to housing and healthcare. With so much uncertainty, students are turning to immigration services and apps like Shira, founded by Bucky Wanda. Her site provides tools that guide students through visa applications, immigration rules, and job searches.
This is the time where a DIY process would not work for you because the immigration is changing per second. So you need to be strategic to be able to say, okay, what are my options?
Amid the uncertainty, Kirakoya says he still believes he can contribute to both his adopted and home countries.
What I plan to do after my training is to gain experience here, look for good opportunities, and after a few years, return to my country because I want to put what I've learned here to good use in the service of my country.
Wanda points out that international students contribute over $22 billion to Canada's economy every year. And she says reducing their numbers could weaken Canada's economy and access to talent. Arzuma Kampowore, VOA News, Calgary, Canada.
From Canada, we come back to South Africa, where finance chiefs say they will make sure that the relief for the continent is top of the agenda at the meeting of G20 finance ministers and central bank governors that began in Cape Town Tuesday. The G20, the group representing the world's top economies, says 54 lower-income countries, 25 in Africa, are spending more on debt repayment than at any time in the last three decades. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Repaying billions of dollars to lending institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and countries such as China and the United States means African nations can't spend much on essential public services. The United Nations and other organizations say Africans suffer as spending on health, education, climate change mitigation, and infrastructure is cut to service debt. Tembisa Fakude, director of the Africa-Asia Dialogues Group in Johannesburg, says poorer countries are forced to take loans at high interest rates because lending institutions consider them to be high risk. In Egypt, for example, the IMF estimates interest payments ate up more than 70% of government revenues in 2024. The figure is 25% for Angola, Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, and Nigeria. Fakude told VOA the Global South is facing the worst debt crisis in 30 years, and he doesn't think G20 deliberations will help much.
They have never been effective. Their commitments are not binding, and with Donald Trump coming in, being unpredictable, I'm not quite sure whether we are going to get what we expect to get. Most of that money that's going to be coming our way, it's not going to be free or grants. These are loans. We have to pay this money back. Most of the African countries are still struggling paying back the COVID loans that were granted to African countries. African countries, of course, are looking at South Africa, that South Africa might just twist some hands and certain things might happen, including the debt relief. But everybody else is talking about other important issues that are impacting the globe. They all have their own commitments. We are seeing the foreign policy positions of many European countries, including the United States, turning and looking inward.
Fakude says indebted African countries shouldn't expect any relief from the United States under President Donald Trump's administration. He says he expects the U.S. to demand that loans be paid in full. The U.S. Treasury Secretary is skipping the G20 finance ministers' meeting this week, as Washington's relations with South Africa have turned frosty. In addition, the top finance officials of Japan, India, Canada, and the European Union are also skipping the meeting. Business Unity South Africa President Busisiwe Mavuso says any discussions about debt relief will be difficult without positive input from the United States, the G20's biggest economy.
Is there something that these multilateral organizations like the G20 and the B20 can do as we move towards this multipolar environment where we are seeing the strong power and strong arm politics? The kind of tensions that you're seeing at the moment from a global perspective, we haven't seen such tensions till 1945. It therefore calls upon us as the business community, as the governments that are in these multilateral organizations to say, how are we going to actually put interventions in place that are going to ensure that we navigate this and our economies are not decimated?
The B20.
That report by my colleague Darren Taylor in Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday, February 26, 2025. We now leave you with Sam Mapangala and the song Maisha Tamu, which means good life. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. For more information on our programs, log on to www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Patrick Dare, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.